Coming up next on Tech News Today, Facebook is coming for the kids with Messenger Kids. Also, 2018 emoji list is nearly complete, and we'll take a look how lost Einsteins are failing to ultimately become inventors and how to buy the right soundbar for Christmas. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, Episode 9, recorded Thursday, December 7th, 2017. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again with Eero's hyper-fast, super-simple Wi-Fi system. And now the second-generation Eero is tri-band and twice as fast. For free overnight shipping to the U.S. or Canada, visit Eero.com, select overnight shipping at checkout, and enter code TNW.
And by Grammarly. Download Grammarly, the intelligent writing app, for free by visiting getgrammarly.com/twit. Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where we talk about tech with the people making and breaking the tech news. I am Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. How's it going? What's up, Megan?
The holidays are getting a little bit stressful for me. I'm feeling the weight. My Christmas cards are out. Did you get mine yet?
I did.
Oh, good.
It was the Stranger Things thing, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Yes. Very talented.
Thank you.
Although I had to explain to my kids why it was funny. Because, you know, they're 7 and they're 4.
Just show them Stranger Things. I love it.
They were like, I don't get it. What is he? I'm like, he's a Christmas tree. Yes, we do have children. Actually, this first story kind of ties directly into our kids. If you're a parent, listen up. Facebook's own terms of service disallow children under the age of 13 from using the service, thanks to the restrictions placed on the company and all companies like it via the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. You may have heard of it as COPPA. Of course, plenty of kids sign up anyways. They just alter their date of birth to do it. But Facebook certainly wants more legitimate access to that valuable pool of younger users. And joining us to talk about the new Messenger Kids app is Larry Magid, technology columnist and CEO of Connect Safely. Welcome, Larry.
Nice to be here. And actually, I'm at the Facebook headquarters in Washington because I was up on Capitol Hill and they were kind enough to host me. So with that as a disclosure, we can move on.
Yeah, he's calling from inside the building. I'm sure they don't mind. You focus much of your work on internet safety, of course, at Connect Safely. Much of that focuses on how children are exposed to the many gray areas of the internet. That's putting it lightly. Tell us a little bit about the new Messenger Kids app and what this actually means for Facebook, why they're doing it.
Well, I think of it as training wheels for social media and messaging, or the other analogy I like to use, kind of like a sandbox. You can injure yourself in a sandbox, but you're much more likely to hurt yourself if you're playing in the street. And so what Facebook did is they created a version of Messenger, or a new, it's really a standalone app. It's different than Messenger, but based on that concept, where the parents have to, first of all, set up the account, and the parents have to approve every contact. So a child cannot reach out to somebody or be reached by anybody unless their parent had approved that person. And beyond that, it's an app that lets you exchange video, it lets you send messages. You can have either group or one-on-one chats. There are stickers, there are gifts, there are masks and all sorts of cool and fun things that kids love to do, and so do adults. And so it's just kind of a fun app designed for 6 to 12-year-olds. And as you pointed out, it is COPPA compliant because parents actually have to set up the account. So it has that verifiable parental consent, which COPPA requires. And it's Facebook's very first product aimed at under 13. Oh, the other thing that's important is that Facebook resisted the temptation, and there are no ads, and they say there's no profiling, and they say that that even the parents aren't going to get ads based on the fact that their kids are signed up. So all of that looks pretty good, and so far so good. I think the app is something that a lot of families are going to enjoy.
So what about looking at the messages? As a parent, if I set that up for my under 13-year-olds, can I see all the videos and pictures that they're sending and the conversations, or is that like their locked diary?
That's TMI, and I think it is their locked diary. And this is a really interesting question. So when I think back to when my kids were little, they would go on play dates, and I would know who they were playing with, and I know where they were. But I didn't hover over their shoulder and listen to every word. I just kind of trusted that they were with a person who they could interact with. And so there isn't that level of knowing everything your kid is saying. Now, having said that, I do want to put in a couple of caveats that no app, and I don't care who makes it or how safe they think it is a substitute for good parenting and good education for your child. So, for example, I don't know of any technology that can completely eliminate cyberbullying. Yes, Messenger has reporting capabilities. You can block people and the parent can block people. But if someone's going to say something mean to you, it's going to get through. And by the same token, if you decide to act out and misbehave, you can do it. The other caveat is it's under parental control, which means there's no stranger danger, no chance or virtually no chance of a stranger coming in and doing something to your kid. But if you have a creepy uncle and mom or dad didn't realize that and they let you interact with them, well, creepy uncle is a creepy uncle and they can be even creepier in person. But the bottom line is that if the parents are, what if for whatever reason, let that person chat with a kid, all bets are off as far as that person is concerned.
I'm going to push back on you a little bit because I know you've been in this business for a long time, protecting kids. So I agree with the idea that, you know, what happens behind the closed door and the play date, is private, but you can't screenshot what happens behind the doors in a play date and send that or post it on the internet. So that's where I see, like, that's a little bit different, comparing, you know, kids playing together as kids messaging each other.
Yeah, I suppose it's possible. I hadn't really tried. I guess you could do a screenshot on your iOS or Android. By the way, it's only iOS now, Android next year. I suppose you probably could do one. Look, I'm not suggesting this is absolutely perfect, that there is nothing that could go wrong. But the reality is that, as Jason pointed out very accurately, kids do lie about their age. In fact, by the millions. And in fact, a study that Dana Boyd did in 2011 found that a very high percentage of parents of 10-year-olds actually helped their kids get onto Facebook, which at the time was the kind of preferred app for kids. So kids are on Facebook, they're on Snapchat, they're on Instagram, they're on Kick. I mean, when I say kids, I mean kids under 13. So there's no perfect solution. I guess you could bubble wrap your kids and lock them up in a cave. But short of that, I mean, this is a pretty safe environment. But again, parenting, constantly reminding your kids, screen time. Right now, the app does not have screen time control. Maybe that'll happen sometime in the future. The parent still has to make sure their kids are doing the right thing and getting out there and getting exercise and meeting people in person and doing all the things the kids should be doing besides interacting online.
Yeah, like you pointed out, the fact that there are a lot of younger users on Facebook, and then, of course, that parents are helping them kind of set up these accounts, so they're giving their stamp of approval about the fact that they're kind of skirting the terms of service in order to get their children onto Facebook. Is there change happening right now in the ways that parents kind of view the effects, the potential effects, both positive and negative, of social networks with their kids? I mean, it's a reality that social media and social networks like Facebook are just so ingrained in our society, and they're so important to the machinations of a lot of things happening right now. Are we thinking about it differently as relates to our kids? Is that part of what this is all about?
I think that's a really good question. I think we're thinking about it differently, not just as it relates to our kids, but as it relates to our democracy, as it relates to our sort of state of mind. Look, on one hand, I think tech is becoming more and more into our lives. I mean, everybody's online. Common Sense Media recently did a study of 0 to 8 and found, I think it was 42% of kids under 8 have access to a tablet. Or maybe even own their own tablet. I mean, the numbers are staggering of how many very young children are online. So that's the positive side. But look, there are negatives that I think people are becoming increasingly aware of. We keep hearing stories. Some of them are exaggerated, like this study that this Professor Twinge came out with out of San Diego, kind of implying that social media is killing kids' interest in dating and killing kids' interest in you know, going to the mall and all this stuff. I don't think there's a lot of evidence that that's really happening, and maybe theoretically, but I'm seeing some still kids. But I think that we are much more conscious of both the benefits and the dangers of technology, and I think that's good. I also think that companies like Facebook and Google are under more scrutiny, certainly by Washington, certainly by Congress. And again, I think in many ways that's probably a good thing, given what happened in the 2016 election. I know that's not about kids, but it's all part of the gestalt about how we view the Internet from the standpoint of safety and security.
And there's so many, I mean, in many ways, Facebook and all these social media companies are black boxes. We don't really know what's going on. A few weeks ago on the show, we talked about Facebook's social graph, like how every time you download an app, it, you know, you'll say, oh, yes, I'll turn over my contacts just so I can log in faster. And I noticed when I was walking through the Facebook Messenger, the Facebook Kids, they do that too. They ask for the kids' contacts. And so do you know anything about whether they are, I know they're not advertising to our kids. I know they're not going to just send our kids right from Messenger Kids into Facebook, but are they creating a social graph of our kids? Like, are they pulling all of their contacts and learning things about them that way?
I don't believe they're creating what would be typical a social graph, because the way the social graph works on the adult Facebook, of course, is that's how they serve ads, and that's how they, I believe, even serve what you see on your newsfeed. Mm-hmm. And there's not going to be any of that on Messenger Kids. So they are collecting data. There's no question about it, that they obviously have to know who the kid is and who the parents are and things of that nature. But I do not believe, at least, and again, you're right, it's a black box. I haven't examined the code, and even if I did, I wouldn't understand it. But what I'm told is that they're not doing those kinds of profiling and social graphs on Messenger Kids. And you're actually right to remind me that there isn't an automatic migration. So, for example, if you compare it to Google Family Link, which is another great service that I really like, if you set up a Family Link account for your kid, that's that Android app that allows a kid to sort of use an Android phone in a sandbox environment. But when the kid turns 13, that turns into a regular adult Google account, or not adult, but a regular 13-year-old Google account, or if they can, if a child had that option, if they choose to. Facebook isn't even doing that. The account just ends, I guess, at age 13, and it's up to the kid to decide what, if any, social media accounts they want to set up.
And I'm sure at that point, I mean, yeah, that's actually a really great way to put it, great point about that I hadn't considered. I've used the Family Link app. My kids are on there, and I didn't really think twice about it because, you know, you end up getting all the conveniences that it affords. I know they're going to be on a tablet. At least now I have control over this. Over yesterday in the office, I was setting up a Kindle Fire 8 kids tablet that has kind of the parental controls on there. And that's great. I don't know what, you know, if there's any sort of conversion in game for Amazon necessarily, other than the fact that you're just using all their services and everything. At least in the case of this app, it really seems like a cut and dry. When it ends, it ends. But you have to imagine that if the kids have been exposed to 3, 4, 5 years of using Facebook Messenger, you know, for kids, and it has the Facebook logo, I mean, Facebook stands to gain a lot. They stand to gain that conversion.
Sure.
It's probably going to happen, but that's a really good point.
They gain a number of ways. They gain in the fact that they're creating mind share for future generations. They gain in the fact that they're obviously ingratiating themselves to parents, assuming the parents are happy with their service, and I think many will be. And so there is a benefit for them. They're not a charitable organization. But on the other hand, I don't attest any cynical motive. First of all, Zuckerberg said back in 2011 that he wanted to figure out a way to serve young children. He was very clear about that. I quote him in my article. Back from when he said that. And the company's been thinking about this for a long time. And, you know, I'm on their safety advisory board. Just by the way, for disclosure purposes, they do provide support for Connect Safely. I don't want to make anybody not know that that's the case. That is the case. But I've been talking to them for years about this as to what they were going to do. And actually, there's been pressure on Facebook, not just internally, but externally, even by some of the safety communities, to try to come up with a product for sub-13s, again, knowing that sub-13s are there anyway, and also knowing that sub-13s are on other services and apps that may not be as safe even as the adult version of Facebook. So having a sandbox-like app, I think, is a really good start for them. And I'm going to take it at their word that they've got all the privacy things. We know that they say they're not collecting a lot of data. And assuming that that's true, and I have no reason to doubt it, I think it's, by and large, a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Larry Magid, it's always great to get you on the network. We really appreciate it, and we appreciate the work that you do in this field. Larry, where would you like people to follow all your work online?
Probably the best place is larrysworld.com, and if I may also say connectsafely.org, that's the nonprofit, and larrysworld.com is sort of all things me.
Awesome. Thank you again, Larry. We will talk to you soon. Have a great
night.
Thanks
so much.
Thanks,
right,
Larry.
Bye-bye.
Put on your party faces, people, because this week we are officially one step closer to the 2018 emoji list.
Oh, I've been waiting.
Oh. Unicode announced the beta version of next year's emoji list, and it includes the list of draft candidates, including man and woman superhero, man and woman supervillain. and the aforementioned party face, as well as woozy face, which comes shortly after party face.
Yes.
Joining us to talk about what this means is Jeremy Burge from Emojipedia. Welcome to the show, Jeremy.
Hello. Hello, everybody. Happy new emoji list. Nearly. I don't want to jump the gun on that.
Right. So in past years, how many of the emoji on the beta list became a reality? In other words, how excited should I be getting about the woman supervillain emoji?
It's pretty high odds. In the last few years, you know what happens? Every year, the protocol has changed a tiny bit, but you're looking at 90%, 95% or so of the by the time we're at this stage, the majority will get through. Maybe one or two will be bumped. Maybe a couple will be added, but we're pretty close.
So this is Emoji 11.0, but the last release was 5.0. What happened to everything in between?
So Unicode has, they have the Unicode standard, which has existed for 25 years, and there's Unicode 1, Unicode 2, and then this emoji standard sat next to it, and that's been Emoji 1, and they've been out of sync. So the last one was Emoji 5, and that synced with Unicode 10, and I think Unicode just went, look, everybody, it's very confusing. Let's just sync it up so that Emoji 11 comes out at the same time as Unicode 11. And incidentally, Emoji 11 relies on the Unicode release anyway, so yeah, it's more a simplicity thing than a Windows jumping, you know, all their version numbers across.
I know we've talked a little bit before in the past on this show about kind of how these emoji are selected and everything, but I'm really curious to know, like, you know, every year there's new ones added. They're added for a number of different reasons. Is there any like particular emoji that keeps getting bumped that's like, it's highly requested, people want it, it's been a long time, people keep expecting it to appear, and nothing? Apparently, maybe it'll come next year or the year after.
This year solves a number of those. I think that's been the case for the last few years, that redheads in particular, I swear, right, every year we get the release comes out, and then the redheads come out in force to say, not again, are you serious? This year, probably the most feedback I've had for something that isn't on the list but might be close would be the flamingo. People love the flamingo, and it's not on there. It's not on the animals, and I think it maybe should be.
Okay, here's a serious question. The petri dish emoji, is that there to represent an actual petri dish, or to, you know, like, say you're about to, like, go into a dirty restroom or something?
You're going to CES.
Yeah.
You know what? So I looked at the proposal for that, and it makes the case for it based on scientific reasons only, and it goes into the importance of science and how much more, in theory, people are into this sort of thing than, say, a Bunsen burner or a lab coat. But in reality, Unicode does look at multiple purposes, so I think it could have multiple uses, and that's where it's interesting to see, right? See how people actually use it in the real world.
Toad Sloth in our chat room would like to make a case for the eyelash mite emoji. Huh? Eyelash mites, you know, the little bugs that live in your eyelashes?
No.
That's something I'm totally unaware of this, too. Now
really?
I'm slightly
mites?
Frightened.
You guys don't know what mites are?
I mean, I know what a mite is.
Yeah, but not on your eyelashes.
Exactly.
Well, that's probably, you don't know. If there were an emoji, you probably would know.
I would. I'd have great awareness of it. I'd like to see the stats on that.
Okay.
Kind of touches a little bit into one of my questions that I had now, which is that how deep do you go with emoji? Because I feel like emoji started off relatively simple. It was like expressions and faces and whatever. Now we're getting down to whatever that was, eyelash mite, which feels very granular. Like, when does the madness end? Like, when are we like, you know what, I think we've done the major things and we're good? Or is this just kind of, this is the beauty of emoji, it's ever evolving?
I mean, everyone has their own perspective, right?
Yeah,
I might
true.
Say, I'm pretty happy with the set, I don't need anything else. And then someone in a different country or a different place goes, no, that's absolutely crazy. Skateboarders, they're always on to it, saying, you know, there's all these other ways of transport and bikes, no skateboard. I don't know. I think we're going to have to see. You get a lot of requests for different dog and cat breeds, and I think that starts getting a bit much, to be honest. So I'm pretty happy with the current list, if I'm completely honest. But, you know, every year you see more things come through that you go, oh, actually, that would be kind of helpful. I like the thread. You saw there was a spool of thread there that you could use on Twitter and or for knitting. There's a knitting needle and there's a thread for sewing. So I think, you know, I like that type of thing that's multiple purposes, right?
That makes sense. The other image on your piece is about the glyphs that can be represented each way. They could flip. And that's getting a lot of attention, and I'm not sure why. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I was surprised by this, too. This is a three-line item in the new emoji update saying, look, we have a mechanism now. It's been asked for years, is can you flip the direction of emoji? And it's sort of been some pushback on it because vendors show emoji in different directions already, so you need some kind of standardization then. And people seem, yeah, I think you're right. I'm seeing way more people saying, that's amazing, I'd love to change the direction of the car or the bike, than a lot of things. And so far what's happened is it's in the spec. There's a recommended way to do it, but there's no particular emojis that have been selected to flip. It wouldn't happen to everything automatically. We'd need to say these 5 or these 50 can change direction. So I think that's, we're going to have to wait and see if any, or if they do, which ones make it in the cut for this year.
There's always an issue also with how different operating systems or different apps represent different emojis. We saw there the water gun, which is just the gun emoji, and it looks like a regular gun in some operating systems. Apple has it look like a water gun, and that can be that can cause some issues. Is there anything in this new list that you see causing controversy like those?
You know, so Unicode tends to be fairly hands-off when it comes to how you implement an emoji. Yes, we've got the sample images. They do make a stronger recommendation in this release that the base character for each person should be gender neutral, which has always been listed there, but there's a bit more language around it to say that often there are 3 characters for everything. There's 3 different versions of the police officer, but most vendors draw the neutral one as male or female. So I think that's the closest thing they've got to recommending a specific appearance. Everything else, they're just going, go for it, guys. It's your domain. If you want to have a water pistol and you want to have a gun, fight it out amongst yourselves and let the market decide, I guess.
I feel like the last couple of years has been very driven by this push towards artificial intelligence and the fact that, you know, machine learning and neural networks and all this stuff can solve complexities of computing and or, you know, take some of the pain points out of it. Do you ever see emoji moving in that way? Because I guess as the emoji library gets more and more detailed and, like we were saying earlier, kind of granular in the things that are represented, I almost envision a future where instead of there being an actual list that is cleared, it's just basically I'm typing and whatever I want a symbol for, I can get it. AI can provide it for me. Do you ever see that happening? Some kind of change to the architecture to make it more of an automatically generated sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, that seems like it should be a logical extension, right? I don't know whether we're talking 5 years or 20 years. Right. Unicode, they do say in their documents, they've said for such a long time, our long-term goal is to make emoji completely customizable. But I really struggle to see exactly how that would happen, and I wonder whether it will. But I mean, it seems logical, right? Of course, we've got pretty damn smart computers, and the fact that we can't just type a word and have a bunch of cool little pictures show up seems a bit of a failing, really. Although it does aid in the fact that we all understand the meaning we give because there's a limited library. That's and if you true. Did allow anything, maybe I'd just be like, what is that? Whereas at least when you send it a lot, you kind of... you don't have to squint so much. You go, oh yeah, that's the party men putting their hands out, and then you know immediately what you're looking at.
Yeah, right.
Well, Jeremy Burge is the editor-in-chief of Emojipedia and host of the Emoji Rap podcast. He can be found at blog.emojipedia.org, where he also offers this year's emoji gift guide. Check it out if you're still looking for something for your emoji lover in your life. Thanks so much for joining us, Jeremy.
No worries. Enjoy that poo emoji battery pack.
Oh, is that what that is? It's like perfect for me.
Yeah.
Megan, that is perfect
amazing.
For me.
Good. Okay. Note to self. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thank you, Jeremy.
All right, thanks, guys.
Have a good night. All right, up next, we talk a little bit about lost Einsteins. We'll tell you a little bit what that means. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Eero, the sponsor of this episode. With Eero, you can install an enterprise-grade Wi-Fi system in your home in just a few minutes. It's not difficult at all. You simply download the Eero app on your iOS or Android device, and it actually walks you through each step of the process. So it's quick, it's easy, it's painless. You can easily create and share a guest network.
You can also know how many devices are connected at any given point. You can also check the internet speed that you're getting from your service provider. It's all easily done through the app. Eero is protected with state-of-the-art WPA2 encryption. Within 24 hours of the crack Wi-Fi vulnerability revelation, which I know you heard about on this show, Eero automatically pushed out a fix to all of their customers. Their incredibly fast response time and ability to push out updates automatically sets Eero apart from other solutions and traditional routers. Second generation Eero and Eero Beacon. You want to hear all about this. The Eero home Wi-Fi system started in early 2016. Since then, they've learned from hundreds of thousands of systems, making them smarter, faster, and more reliable. And the new Eero second generation and Eero Beacon allow a customer to build a Wi-Fi system that's more perfectly tailored for their home than ever before. They also offer more speed, more range, and the same high-quality, elegant design that people have come to expect. Also, with the addition of a third 5 gigahertz radio, the second generation Eero is now tri-band and twice as fast as its predecessor, which lets customers do more simultaneously in every room of their home. And with the addition of a new Thread radio, Eero can connect to low-power devices such as locks, doorbells, other sensors, and more. Expanding your coverage in any room is easy with Eero Beacon. You simply plug it into a wall, and then you're covered. That's all you have to do, plug it in the wall. You can add as many Eero Beacons as you want. If there's an outlet, there's Wi-Fi. It's as simple as that. We have one in our bedroom. We absolutely love it. For free overnight shipping to U.S. or Canada, visit Eero.com, E-E-R-O.com, and at checkout, select overnight shipping. Then make sure to enter TNW. That'll make it free, the shipping free. That's Eero.com and enter code TNW. And we thank Eero for their support of Tech News Weekly.
Here is a fact for you. Low-income students who score in the top 5% of all third graders in math are no more likely to become inventors than below-average math students from affluent families. In other words, you might be smart, but if you don't have money, you might become what one new economic research paper calls a lost Einstein. Race, ethnicity, and geography play a role in the success or lack of success of high-performing students. And this, the paper's authors say, is stifling innovation. Joining us to talk about how this is affecting the tech industry is one of the paper's authors, Alex Bell, a PhD candidate in the Harvard Economics Department studying inequality and innovation. Thanks so much for coming on, Alex.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So in the abstract of your paper, you and your colleagues say growing up in a neighborhood or a family with a high innovation rate in a specific technology class leads to a higher probability of patenting in exactly the same technology class. Tell us a little bit more about what that means.
That's right. So one of the things that we're interested in studying here is just generally who becomes an inventor. And one of the striking things that we find is that kids who grew up around inventors are much more likely to become inventors themselves. It's suggestive to us that there may be some sort of exposure effect of being exposed to an inventor on a child's likelihood of becoming an inventor his or herself. And as you mentioned, we find that these exposure effects are technology specific. So it's not just the case that growing up around inventors makes you become an inventor yourself, but growing up around inventors in computer categories is also more likely to make the kid become an inventor in a computer technology category.
So what data did you use in your research?
So in order to study this question, we used a data set of about 1 million patents that were granted by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. Patents are often thought of in economics as a measure of innovation and innovative activity. But one of the problems with patent data is you know very little about the people who are applying for the patents. So the patent office doesn't collect any statistics on race or gender or the family backgrounds of the inventors. So in order to study those questions, we link the patent data to some administrative data sets of tax records and school data to understand the types of people who are filing for patents in the United States.
In your paper, you point to the third grade as being kind of a marked point where you start to see some differences. Explain that a little bit. Why is the third grade so important to the study?
That's right. So one of the questions in the paper is how much do differences in ability as measured by some test scores relate to the disparities that you mentioned these disparities being the differences in patent rates from kids from very different backgrounds. And one finding of the paper is that although test scores in early childhood are actually surprisingly predictive of which kids are going to go on to file a patent later in life, those test scores don't differ all that much for the kids from high and low income backgrounds early on in life. Yet the patenting rates for the kids from these very different backgrounds is quite stark. We see this as evidence that there are differences in the kids' environments that emerge over their life. Although we don't see differences in these math test scores in early years, you see these differences grow over the lifetime. So by eighth grade and by college, there are very different measures of test scores for kids from low and high income backgrounds. And it's consistent with a story in which their environments are different and they're not accumulating the skills that they need to become inventors.
Is there anything that we can tell before third grade? Because as you mentioned in your paper, a lot can happen between zero and third grade. Is there any, I know you didn't look at this, but is there any way to look at, to measure ability at age zero?
That's right. No, that's a very good question. This is something other papers have tried to do. There's some very cool work by other economists, Roland Fryer and Steve Levitt. Apparently, there are ways to measure the cognitive ability of infants. They involve how they react to puzzles and things like that, and it's called the Bayley score of infant development. And all the literature that I've seen in that area seems to indicate that there are no detectable differences in ability, at least by race, by the age of 9 months.
Now, obviously, when you do a study like this and you're looking at a large pool of children in this case, growing up and everything, there's a majority, let's say, that fall into, the categories that you spell out. But there will be outliners. There will be people. So there will be children who grew up without, let's say, those role models, or who grew up in lower opportunity areas, yet are able to kind of be successful and make that conversion as they get older. Was there any identifiable trademark of those children to know what was different in their exposure and in their world versus the rest?
That's right. That's a good question. So you're asking, what can we say about the sort of kids that make it despite all the odds? One thing that I will say is that they tend to have very high test scores. So inventors in general, essentially no one becomes an inventor unless they have a test score above two standard deviations above the mean, essentially, which is a pretty high test score. So even the kids that do make it through from poor backgrounds tend to have very high test scores. And then second, we generally find that an important factor in who becomes an inventor, like I mentioned before, is exposure to inventors. So we do see higher innovation rates in neighborhoods that have more inventors themselves. And it's suggestive to me that mentors and role models and things like that may be having some effect here also.
Yeah, that map that was published in the New York Times is amazing to look at. That's what caught my eye and made me want to reach out to you. So the paper talks about this big gap between rich and poor. What about middle class families? Where do they fall in this?
That's a good question. So I've been actually very surprised to what extent middle class families seem to do not that much better than poor families. And one finding of the paper that's really startled me is how much innovation has actually been sort of concentrated among the very high income families. And we're really talking about families in the top 20% or so of the income distribution. The top 20%, I'm talking about families that make over about $100,000 of family income per year. So it's somewhat of a puzzle still why innovation is so remarkably skewed toward the very rich families. But I think that it may have something to do with the social networks and access to institutions that come with the sort of access to privilege.
Mm-hmm. And then kind of touching on what you talked about a few minutes ago, as far as role models are concerned, if that ends up being, a big key part of this, like, what's happening to improve children's exposure and particularly in areas that would be affected here to the right kinds of role models, the right connections that they can make so that they're exposed to those people that would inspire them, motivate them to move forward?
So in terms of what can be done, I think that it's important to think about targeting interventions at children from underrepresented groups who excel in math and science, but to do so at younger ages in particular. Mm-hmm. You know, we've talked about how this is really a pipeline problem, and it's important to start early. But not just starting early, but also tailoring programs to participants' backgrounds. And what I mean by that is we see, for instance, women are much more influenced by the patterning activities of women around them than of men around them. And I think that there's this phrase tossed around, you know, you can't be what you can't see. I think it's important for people to have role models, but not just role models. They need role models that are like them. Mm. So I think that's important to keep in mind going forward also.
So the papers about lost Einsteins that we mentioned before, these people that might have been an Einstein or a Steve Jobs or, you know, any a Grace Hopper, any of these people that aren't, is there any way to know of knowing who they are? I mean, do we know? Is there any way of tracing them, or are they just invisible?
No, I think it's really difficult to point to any one kid and say that kid there was a lost Einstein. We know that there are, you know, a lot of kids with very high math test scores that seem like they should be qualified to become an inventor later in life, but they don't. And we see that they're primarily coming from disadvantaged backgrounds in terms of parental income, and they seem to be coming from minority races. And that's as far as we can say right now.
Alex, thank you so much for joining us. Alex is part of a team of writers, researchers, scientists who are working on this, and they're also working on a project called the Equality of Opportunity Project. So you can check that out at equality-of-opportunity.org. What is the best place to follow you and this work that you're doing, Alex?
Yeah, I would definitely check out the Equality of Opportunity website, and it's got some other great information about studies on economic mobility in particular.
Thanks so much for talking to us, Alex.
Thank you, Alex.
Great. Thanks very much.
All right. Keep up the great work.
After the break, Scott Wilkinson from the AVS Forum is here to tell us about the gifts for the home theater enthusiast on your list. But first, let's talk about our sponsor, Grammarly. Grammarly's AI-powered products help people communicate more effectively. I use Grammarly every day to help prove that I'm better and smarter than everyone by always knowing when to use the word less and when to use the word fewer. You can be as petty about grammar as I am by using Grammarly. Copy and paste any English text into Grammarly's online text editor or install Grammarly's free browser extension for Chrome, Safari, and Firefox. Grammarly corrects hundreds of grammar, punctuation, and spelling mistakes while also catching contextual errors, improving your vocabulary, and suggesting some style improvements to give your writing some more flair. Grammarly scans your text for common and also complex grammatical mistakes, like subject-verb agreement, modifier placement, comma splice, weak adjectives, missing articles, the difference between there and your, things I can get away with on this podcast, but you can't get away with in writing. Grammarly's powerful algorithms are developed by the world's leading linguists and language lovers. Improve your skills with Grammarly's detailed explanations for all your mistakes and weekly progress reports. Write confidently and mistake-free on Gmail, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and nearly anywhere else you write on the web. Be sure to check out Grammarly's Facebook and Twitter accounts for fun grammar tips and discussions. The Grammarly blog also offers daily tips and inspirations and insights on how to improve your day-to-day writing to achieve personal and professional goals and to be better and smarter than everyone else, like me. Get started and join more than the 10 million happy Grammarly Chrome users today. Download Grammarly now for free at getgrammarly.com/twit. That's getgrammarly.com/twit, and we thank Grammarly for their support.
So if you didn't know already, if I'm reminding you, Christmas right around the corner, just, you know, heads up, that someone in your life might be like 2 years ago me. I wanted an upgrade to our home theater setup, of which we had very little. In my case, we had suffered with the speakers on our 50-inch TV for years. Finally wanted to upgrade the sound, but didn't have the time or the patience to match an amplifier with like a 5.1 speaker setup or a 7.1 setup. We wanted a high quality, easy to use soundbar setup. And we got one that we've been pretty happy with. If that's you, then Scott Wilkinson from AVS Forum has you covered, and he joins us now. Welcome, Scott. It's great to talk with you.
Hey, Jason. Good to be here.
It's good to have you back. So you wrote a little last month about the best soundbars of the year. Audiophiles might say soundbars aren't good enough. Where do you stand on that sentiment?
Well, yeah, audiophiles might say that. And I will.
And sometimes do.
And I will say that, you know, if you want the ultimate in sound quality, you really do want a separate 5.1 or 7.1 or Atmos speaker system. But that is so complex for many people. And even if someone might be willing to put the time and effort into setting something like that up, they might not have the room for it. You know, right. A bedroom or a separate, or there might be the spousal acceptance factor. I don't want all those speakers around the room. So what do? You took the approach that I recommend very often, which is whatever you do, don't just be satisfied with the speakers in your TV because they're almost universally horrible. And the way to really get a significant improvement in your sound quality when watching TV is with a soundbar.
Yeah. So, and I'm sure soundbar technology has evolved over the years. What kind of new technology is being integrated into these soundbars now to make them sound and perform even better than before?
Sure. Well, there's lots of them. There's the placement of the drivers themselves. There is advanced DSP, digital signal processing, which helps to expand what we call the sound stage or the width of the sonic image that you're listening to, placing speakers, drivers in different positions and pointing them in different directions also helps quite a bit. So I would say those are primarily the important ones. There is one new technology that isn't included really in, I don't think anyway, in those soundbars that we listed in that article, which is something called beamforming, which is you take a bunch of little speakers and with a combination of DSP and constructive destructive sonic interference, you can actually steer different channels like the right channel over here and the left channel over there in a very effective manner. I think we're going to see a lot of that in soundbars in the next year or two. There are already a couple that are available, but we're going to see more of that in the future. For now, though, it's really more about where the drivers are placed, the acoustics of the casing that's there, and the DSP that is now much more powerful than it's ever been, and that's going to continue. Mm-hmm.
So I am cheap. What was the least expensive soundbar that you recommend? Or what's the price range that you wouldn't go under and wouldn't be worth it?
Sure. That's a great idea. Great question. The article that I posted that Jason referred to is really the best soundbars that we on AVS Forum reviewed. But that doesn't mean they're the only ones that are worth buying. I'd say my least expensive pick, which we didn't get to this year. I hope we do next year. There are several models from Vizio. Now, Vizio, you probably know for their TVs, which I really like. They're a great value, low price, great quality, really excellent. And the same thing goes for their soundbars. They have a wide variety, actually, of different sizes to fit under different size TVs. And they come all the way from just the soundbar itself, which is basically a stereo pair of speakers or a left-right kind of thing, to 2.1, which adds a subwoofer, to 5.1, which adds the actual physical surround speakers in the backs. And to answer your question, the 28-inch 2.1 soundbar with a subwoofer goes for $130. So that's not too bad. Again, the larger one you get, you'd get a larger one if you have a larger TV. The 36-inch, let me see here. The 36-inch 2.1 is $150. The 38-inch goes for $220. So, you know, we're really not talking that much money. And the improvement in sound, I will say it as many times as I need to, is significant over the quality of the sound you get from the TV's own speakers. Because the TVs are so thin these days, there's no acoustic space for the speakers to generate a kind of a good a good sound, which is why these sound bars are so much better. As I said earlier, the acoustic space of the cabinet really makes a big difference in the quality of the sound, if you do it right. And the companies that we've been talking, that I have been reviewing and we've been talking about, really do that well. Samsung, Sony, Vizio, and I believe Polk is also in our best of list. They did a pretty amazing job for $300, I think it is.
So you wouldn't recommend like a 28-inch soundbar for a 65-inch TV then?
No. I think you really do want to kind of think about how big is your TV and get a soundbar that's of an appropriate size for that size of TV.
Yeah, I actually just looked it up. There was a, and then of course my browser just went all wonky on me. But the soundbar that we did get was a Vizio. It was a 40-inch Vizio 5.1 soundbar system. It was a 2015 model. I think it was somewhere like $300. And I consider myself, you know, I'm a music fan.
You are a musician, in fact, as well.
A musician. I consider myself like dialed into this stuff. I can't believe that we went for years with the audio coming out of our TV speaker.
Man.
We were lazy and we finally upgraded. And let's say it's not as good as like a fully integrated, you know, completely separate speaker system with its own dedicated amplifier, but it's so much better than it was.
It's
and we're so,
so
happy we
better.
Did it.
I'm glad to hear you did that because, yeah, it's a major improvement. If you want to go even farther, you can get those separate speakers. But if you don't have the room or you don't have the family that will accept speakers all over the place, then soundbar is a great alternative.
You also listed some soundbars that, let's just say, they aren't messing around when it comes to the price. Samsung Sound, the Sony soundbars that you listed, anywhere between almost $1,200 and $1,500. Mm-hmm. So now you're talking about soundbars with a premium price tag. How do you justify that?
Well, unless you're quite well off, it would be difficult to justify. There's no question about it. Now, these very expensive soundbars do sound amazing. I think Mark Henninger, who wrote the review of the Samsung, at least, said he was on occasion, he was in his kitchen doing something, and he forgot that what he was listening to was a soundbar. So the quality really, really got up there quite a bit. And when you get up there in the $1,000 plus range, the Sony HT-ST5000 is actually a full Atmos soundbar. So again, by using DSP and speaker drivers that are positioned in different ways, including facing straight up, you can actually get this immersive sound field, which is called Dolby Atmos, and it has sounds not only coming from around your head, but also from overhead.
Wow.
And that is quite a nice effect, and this Sony soundbar does it. Now, if you're quite well off, and maybe you have a dedicated home theater, this is not going to be what you're going to buy. You're going to get real speakers that are around the room and overhead and so on and so forth. But what if you're really well off and you've got a bedroom and your spouse doesn't want all those speakers around, but you want a better sound, you want as good a sound as you can get, as you can afford, the Sony or the Samsung, either one would be awesome. It would just sound so good without having to, you know, put a bunch of speakers all around the room. That's really the main point here.
Right. Kind of cleans it up.
Exactly.
From that perspective. Exactly. Now, we have an email from a fan, Michael, who writes, "I've been looking at many different soundbars and never know which one to purchase. Now that Sonos has released a soundbar with Alexa capability, it's made my decision even more difficult." What do you think about the Sonos Playbar?
Well, it's a very well regarded soundbar. I believe we reviewed it in 2016, probably, so it didn't make this list. But it was a very well reviewed soundbar. We liked it quite a bit. It was pretty expensive. It was in the, I don't remember now, $400 or $500.
Looks like it's listed for $700 on this page.
$700. Okay, yeah. So Sonos products are generally very, very good, high quality, good performance, but expensive. And they also form a kind of a closed ecosystem, right? The Sonos is a wireless, made its name on a wireless whole home audio kind of system, but they use a dedicated mesh network, and it's quite proprietary. Now that they have a skeleton on it, great. But so does many, many others. Right. They're not the only ones. So, you know, it's a good product, but it's expensive. And I think you can get almost as good quality for a lot less money.
Speaking of a closed ecosystem, the Apple's HomePod doesn't. It got delayed until next year. What have you read about it that makes? What are your thoughts on it? I know you haven't obviously tried it. None of us have. But what are your thoughts on it?
No, I haven't tried it yet. I am a big Apple fan. I use Macintosh and iPhone and iPad and so on. So I do have a strong preference for their products in terms of quality, in terms of design, and so on and so forth. So I imagine the HomePod will be very good as well. I haven't spent a lot of time with this kind of type or voice command type systems. I'm dedicated to getting into that next year, but it's sort of peripheral for me. I'm more into home theater, so. You know, the TV, the big screen TV, the speakers or the soundbar, the controlling it all with the voice sounds like a great idea. I just haven't had a lot of experience with it yet. Talk to me again next year.
Okay.
Scott Wilkinson, it's always great getting you on the show and talking with you. Really appreciate you taking time to share with us your thoughts on soundbars this year for Christmas. Thank you.
Always happy to do it. My pleasure. And wish everybody happy holidays. And hope you find something really cool audio or video under the tree.
Oh, so do I. Where can people find your cool audio and video opinions on the internet?
Well, my website, the website of which I am the editor, is avsforum.com. So be sure to check that out. We post stuff there all the time. You can also email me at scott@avsforum.com if you have any questions. Or in particular, I do answer reader questions on the site. And generally, those come to asktheeditors@avsforum.com. So either way, you can get to me, and hopefully I'll be able to address your questions on the site.
Awesome. Scott Wilkinson, thank you so much for taking time. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right. Have a great night.
After 6 months of controversy, the city of San Francisco just kicked delivery robots to the curb. Citizens groups wanted to put a ban on our future robot overlords, but instead they insisted upon certain restrictions, including robots operating only in certain areas with low pedestrian traffic, and that with a total of only 761 blocks in the city that they're required to stay within. The mini machines would also need a permit that would restrict the number of delivery robots to only 9 at any one time and only 3 per permittee. Among the officials who were pro-robot was Supervisor Malia Cohen, who said the ban would stifle innovation. She also envisioned a world in which these robots wouldn't just deliver lazy people's pizza, but would do things like pick up dirty hypodermic needles that cover the streets in some areas of the city.
Do you think San Francisco sidewalks would be friendly to robots?
Well,
rolling around?
I think there's this idea of like a dystopian idea that they would just cover the streets. Like, I don't know where that idea comes from. Like, this is the same with drones. Like, people think, oh no, they're just going to fill the skies.
Right.
And I don't think it's going to be that quick. And I think if any place is friendly to robots on the sidewalk, it would be San Francisco. So this doesn't bode well for those companies.
Yeah, no kidding. It's kind of not what I would have expected to happen in a city like San Francisco. I would imagine they'd be a little bit more open or welcoming to the technology. But we fear robots, and that's just a part of our human, you know, that's just part of us being human, is that we fear robots.
It's FUD.
Right? Yeah.
It's all FUD.
Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific, 5:30 p.m. Eastern. You can be part of the show by emailing us. Send us your thoughts like we had earlier today, tnw@twit.tv. You can also subscribe to the show at twit.tv/tnw.
And we have a request for you. If you liked an interview that we did this year, if you liked seeing or hearing from a particular person, if you thought their ideas were great, if you thought the story they had to tell was fabulous and more people needed to see it, email us. We're putting together our best of episode and we want your help. Go to twit.tv/best of or email me at megan@twit.tv. You can fill out the form or fill up whatever information you remember. Don't do much too much work. That's our job. You just, if you have an idea, put in whatever you remember, and you can be part of making these special shows that will air between the week of Christmas and New Year's. And yeah, maybe the interview was on a different show. Just put in everything that you remember, and someone will look at it and find it and put together the best shows for you to listen to or watch while you're avoiding your family during the holidays. And if you want to tweet at me about specific ways in which you avoid your family, I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to Josh. Thanks to Jammer B. Thanks to Berg. Thanks to everybody, because they're all awesome. And we're going to go party after this. And thanks to you for joining us this week on another episode of Tech News Weekly. We'll see you all next week. Bye, everybody.